Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, mystery domes found on the moon, research on a treatment for Alzheimer's disease, and sky-watching Mars and Jupiter. Here's a scientist's soundbite.
You know, there are some who would say that the moon is uninteresting, that it's geologically dead, and that we have been there and done that. And what this finding reminds us is that the moon is geologically complex, and it has surprises left for us to discover.
That was planetary scientist Bruce Jolliffe of Washington University in St. Louis. More with him later, but first, Emily Howard joins us for Science News of the Week. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge. On August 23rd, a 5.9 magnitude earthquake struck the U.S. eastern seaboard, causing buildings to sway and rattling the people inside of them. There were numerous injuries, but no reports of serious injury or death. It was the largest earthquake in the Virginia seismic region since 1897. Seismologists say it was not related to the 5.3 magnitude earthquake that struck southern Colorado almost exactly 12 hours earlier. The southern Colorado earthquake was the largest in that region since 1973.
Two new reports presented at World Water Week in Stockholm this week, held August 21st through 27th of 2011, illustrate the vital connection between the availability of fresh water and food production. These reports outline a new approach to farming called an agro-ecosystem approach. It takes into account that food production takes 70 to 90% of some areas' available water. What's more, in many of the world's richest agricultural regions, water limits are close to being reached or breached, these experts say. These regions include the plains of northern China, India's Punjab, and the western United States.
In the August 2011 issue of the journal Environmental Science and Technology, two scientists report that microbes are key ingredients to oil spill cleanups. They looked back at the two worst oil spills in U.S. history, last year's Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico, and the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill in Prince William Sound off the coast of Alaska. The ecosystems of the two cases were very different, these scientists say. But in both cases, microorganisms played a major role in cleaning the spilled oil. As one of the scientists told the press, the fate of all oil spills depends upon a unique set of circumstances that will govern risks and impacts. But the one common denominator in a successful cleanup is oil-degrading microbes.
A Russian Progress spacecraft crashed on August 24th, shortly after takeoff. The craft was unmanned, and there were no injuries. The crash followed a malfunction in the spacecraft's booster rocket, according to a statement from Roscosmos, the Russian space agency. The Progress craft was carrying 3.5 tons of cargo to the International Space Station. The crew aboard the space station say they have enough supplies on hand to last 2 months until the next scheduled supply run on October 28th.
Scientists have estimated the total number of species on Earth at 8.7 million, give or take 1.3 million. They say this is one of the most precise calculations ever offered of the number of species on Earth. About 75% of species are thought to live on land. About 25% of the total are thought to dwell in the ocean depths. Of these 8.7 million estimated species on Earth, 86% or more have yet to be discovered, described, and cataloged. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Interviews after this. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Beth Lebwohl joins us with a report on a treatment for Alzheimer's disease being done by researchers at Yale University. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you, Jorge. This week I spoke to a fellow named Seth Herzen, who's a chemist at Yale. He was experimenting with a new treatment for Alzheimer's, a treatment that's actually derived from a type of moss found in China. And scientists got the idea for this experiment because this moss has actually been used for thousands of years in traditional Chinese medicine, and for the past 15 years or so in more clinical Chinese practice. So here's what he had to say.
There's a moss that grows in China. This moss basically makes huperzine, so it's a small molecule that's produced by the moss. And what they do in China is they literally grind up the moss and they have a means to extract the molecule. They found that people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's respond pretty well when given huperzine on a daily basis in China. And so since about 1996, doctors over there have been prescribing it to treat these patients and help to alleviate some of the symptoms associated with the early stages of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, is this a question or a case of Eastern medicine meets Western medicine?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, so yeah, that's actually how it began. You know, in China, they used to sort of make teas and different sort of concoctions from it over thousands of years as a way to treat different ailments. And what they ultimately found is that huperzine is one of the active ingredients in there. So it definitely has its roots in Eastern medicine and sort of traditional folk medicine.
You are obviously engaged in the field of Western medicine, or at least chemistry. What is its physical action, let's say, on the body?
Yeah, so its primary mode of action involves inhibiting an enzyme known as acetylcholine esterase. And it's been found that people with different neurodegenerative diseases have reduced levels of acetylcholine in their brain. And that has been linked to the symptoms of these different diseases, including Alzheimer's. And so the basic strategy then is if you can sort of inhibit the enzyme that decreases the concentrations of acetylcholine, you can increase the concentrations of this small molecule in these patients and thereby reduce the symptoms.
Can you give me a bottom line on that statement without using such technical terms or, you know, words that people...
That was the non-technical version.
Okay. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Let me give you the bottom line. The bottom line is that it's been shown in China for about 15 years that huperzine can help to alleviate the symptoms of Alzheimer's.
Okay. When you say alleviate symptoms, you mean?
Help to improve memory and improve cognition.
Ah, I see. Okay. And so when might we see this compound on the market? And I guess I should also find out what's so novel about what you're doing. Why is it so, how is it so new and different if the Chinese have been doing this for thousands of years?
Yep. So to answer the first part of that question, what we're going to be able to do now is to initiate clinical studies in the United States. Basically, I'm sure you probably know this, but anytime you want to take a drug to market, you have to go through three or four stages of clinical trials. And so we're now in a position to do that. The reason why sort of our work is significant and what our contribution is that we now have, for the first time, in the United States, a stable and reliable and economical source of huperzine. Okay, this is basically our work. So in our work, we're able to make this molecule in the lab.
Why would the source otherwise not be reliable?
Yeah, so the issue is that the plant, the moss that produces huperzine, is most abundant in China, okay, which isn't, you know, the end of the world, but it does create sort of export-import issues in terms of getting it into the United States. The second major issue, which is probably more significant, is the fact that this moss grows very slowly. So it takes about 20 years to grow to any sort of significant size. So it's about 20 years before you can harvest it. And what that means is basically as they've gone after natural huperzine, they've essentially harvested away this plant. And now the number of those species are in significant decline. So there's a danger of sort of long-term, sustainability of the natural source. And so having a synthetic route, like the one that we've developed, enables you to sort of sidestep that issue. Now we can make it in the lab. We don't need to go out and collect moss and sort of deal with all of those issues.
Gotcha. How is the Department of Defense, or rather the U.S. Army, involved in this project?
Yeah, so the acetylcholine esterase inhibitory activity is actually quite important from a chemical warfare point of view. So you've probably heard of things like sarin and VX. Basically, these chemical warfare agents will actually bind irreversibly to acetylcholine esterase. And so the hypothesis is that if you were to treat a soldier or a law enforcement officer or whoever, maybe it's, you know, someone that's potentially going to be exposed to these agents, if you were to treat them with huperzine, what would you do? Well, you would bind their acetylcholinesterase, okay? And so what that means then is if they went into a situation where they got exposed to these chemicals, the enzyme is already tied up with huperzine. And so it can't react with the chemical warfare agent. And so then your body just metabolizes it and it gets excreted. What huperzine can do is essentially provide protection against these agents. And so that's what the Army wants to look at.
Who funded this study?
Yale.
Ah, I see. And yeah. What's the most important thing you'd like to tell Earth Sky's global audience about your August 2011 study on huperzine?
I would basically say that, you know, now for the first time we have a reliable and sort of economical source of synthetic huperzine, and so we can now begin to look at its clinical potential.
And relative to other Alzheimer's treatments, how do you think this might stand in terms of its effectiveness?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that it could be better. Basically, what's most commonly prescribed for Alzheimer's are other acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, but they don't really stop the disease. They're kind of like taking Tylenol, okay, like to relieve a headache. It takes care of the symptoms, but it doesn't stop the progression of Alzheimer's. There's a lot of evidence that huperzine may actually be able to do that, and so now we're going to be able to ask those questions and find out if that truly is the case.
Encouraging news on a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth LeBois. We're Earth Sky, broadcast on 1,200 stations globally, including Voice of America. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about the global night sky this week and to answer a question many people have asked. What's happening in late August of 2011 with the planet Mars? Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. So what's happening is that here again in 2011, an email is circulating about the planet Mars, suggesting that Mars will appear as large as a full moon in the sky on August 27th, 2011. And by the time some of you hear this, that date will have passed, and you will know that Mars did not appear as large as a full moon on August 27th. Mars can never appear as large as a full moon, and this is a hoax. The planet Mars is a planet like Earth in orbit around the Sun, and it stays in that orbit. It has about a 2-year cycle by which we see it in our sky, but we never see Mars as anything more than a very bright star.
So, but Mars will appear in the night sky in August, is that right?
Right. Mars is in the sky in August of 2011. Because Mars is a small, rocky world like Earth, and it's just one step farther than we are in orbit around the Sun, it looks sometimes very bright in our sky and sometimes very faint, depending on whether it's on the same side of the Sun that we're on. In August of 2011, Mars is visible, but it's in the morning sky. It's very faint. Actually, it's getting brighter. It was fainter earlier in 2011, and as 2011 has progressed, we've seen Mars get brighter, and the reason for that is that right now Earth is catching up to Mars on that big racetrack of the solar system, and we're going to pass between the Sun and Mars in March of 2012. At that time, Mars will be bright, very bright in our sky, like a bright red star, but nowhere near the size of a full moon.
And what about the planet Jupiter?
Yeah, the planet to watch right now is really Jupiter. Jupiter is the fifth planet outward in orbit around the Sun, and it's not a small rocky world like Mars and Earth. Jupiter is a big gas giant planet. It's the largest planet in our solar system, and unlike Mars, which is sometimes faint in our sky and sometimes bright, Jupiter is always bright. So right now, in August 2011, Jupiter is coming up at midnight. It's a very bright, bold, white planet. It'll appear over the eastern horizon in the wee hours after midnight, and it's more or less overhead at dawn. So many people are beginning to notice Jupiter now, not only because it's bright, but also because it's moving closer to the evening sky. As we travel around the sun, the planets, the outer planets, start out in the morning sky, and then they slowly shift over into the evening sky, and that's what Jupiter is doing right now. So, for example, Jupiter was near the moon earlier in August, around the middle of the month of August, and so many people wrote in and said they noticed this bright object near the moon because it's up in a part of the sky that, you know, people are still awake and they're moving around and they're seeing this object. So over the next few months, there's going to be even more of that because Jupiter's rising earlier every evening. It's going to be appearing, rising in the east first in late evening, then in mid-evening, then in early evening when the sun goes down. That'll be around the end of October 2011. So watch for this very, very bright planet, the planet Jupiter. It's going to be the best planet to see between now and the end of this year.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Earth's moon surprised scientists with the discovery of mysterious volcanic domes found on its far side. The results were published in the July 2011 issue of Nature Geoscience. On the line to explain what was found is lead author and planetary scientist Bradley Jolliffe of Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Jolliffe, welcome.
Oh, glad to be here.
Now, tell us about these dome-shaped volcanic features that were found on the moon. If you wouldn't mind telling us about this study that you've recently co-authored, what were the findings of the study? What was discovered?
Sure. Well, let me give you just a very quick background. Back in 1998, the Lunar Prospector mission, which mapped the moon with a gamma-ray spectrometer, noted that there's a hot spot on the far side of the moon in a place we really didn't expect it, and it's a very pinpoint sort of location. But at that time, it was not known what the cause of it was. So more recently, with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is mapping and orbiting the moon right now, and has some very powerful telescopes that actually look at the surface, we're able to actually see these features in some detail, and when we could do that, we saw that there are indeed volcanic features at the surface. So this is a new finding, and we've written about this in the Nature Geosciences paper.
So what is unusual about these volcanic features that have been described as shaped like a dome?
Right. The dome shape actually gives us a clue. The composition of the lava in this case to make a dome shape like this is silicic. That means it's rich in the element silicon. Now, this is not unique on the moon, but it certainly is unusual and so far not seen anywhere else on the far side. So when I say it's silicic, that's compared to the dark lavas that fill in the familiar dark circular basins on the moon's near side that you see when you look up at the moon, the side facing Earth. That lava is richer in elements like iron and magnesium, and that's the case for most of the moon's lava flows. Then there's the apparent or relative age of this Kampen-Velkovich volcanic complex, as we call it. Its features aren't so heavily degraded or cratered as one might expect if it was 3.5 to 4 billion years old, like much of the other volcanism on the moon. So if it's relatively young, then we need an explanation, because most researchers think that the moon was sort of volcanically dead, with only a few exceptions, after about 3 billion years ago. That's because it's a small planetary body, and as such, it cooled and lost most of its internal heat more rapidly than larger bodies like Mars and Venus and Earth. So to really nail down that age, though, we need not just the orbital images, but we'd love to have samples. So basically, what this finding does is to kind of challenge the notion that the moon was volcanically simple and restricted in time, composition, and space. Because not only do we find these silicic domes, but we find them on the far side, and we find them in a case that we think may be significantly younger than some of the other occurrences. The significance of this, in sort of a broad sense, for me, is that, you know, there are some who would say that the moon is uninteresting, that it's geologically dead, and that we have been there and done that.
And what this finding reminds us is that the moon is geologically complex, and it has surprises left for us to discover. It's a place that I would very much love for the human spaceflight program to be able to go to explore as we learn how to live off of Earth and in space, and using the moon as a stepping stone to other places. It's just one of a number of very geologically interesting locations that that would be great to explore in person with astronauts.
Dr. Jolla, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, you're certainly welcome.
That was planetary scientist Bradley Jolliffe. That's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, 100 Flowers, Sounda, The Bright Light Social Hour, Maneja Beto, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.